From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Book Week continues with advice from the authors of books on how to speak and what not to wear. Patsy Rodenberg is a vocal coach who has trained some of England's top actors, including Judi Dench, Daniel Day-Lewis, Maggie Smith, and Nicole Kidman. She's written books for actors as well as for the rest of us. Trini Woodall and Susanna Constantine host the BBC series What Not to Wear, one of the first hit makeover shows. Their book of the same name is a bestseller. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. North Korea threatened today to declare itself a nuclear weapons state and carry out a nuclear test, but the White House brushed that off as inflammatory rhetoric. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
The North Korean threats came during the second day of six-nation talks in Beijing. A North Korean diplomat also told the talks his government has the means to deliver a nuclear bomb, according to U.S. officials. This was an apparent reference to the North Korean missile program. The U.S. has heard similar threats before over the past year, and White House spokeswoman Claire Buchan in Crawford, Texas, noted that North Korea has had a long history of making inflammatory comments. Buchan called the talks positive and said there has been excellent cooperation between the U.S. and the other nations at the talks, China, Russia, Japan, and South Korea. These nations agree with the United States that North Korea must end its nuclear weapons program. North Korea is demanding a non-aggression pact with the U.S. in exchange for giving up what it calls its nuclear deterrent. Mike Schuster, NPR News.
The Bush administration has indicated that it would welcome a multinational force in Iraq with a UN mandate so long as it was commanded by an American. Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage mentioned the possibility this week in an interview with regional newspapers. Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, the commander of the U.S. forces in Iraq, said today that there's no need for more U.S. troops in the country, but that soldiers from other countries would be welcome.
I think it's very important that multinational forces come into the country. What it shows is a tremendous commitment on the part of the world community to the future of Iraq, and not just the United States and the current 29 other countries that are here.
There are currently 136,000 U.S. troops in Iraq and about 13,000 from other countries, most of them from Britain. The Transportation Security Administration is reminding travelers this holiday weekend to be careful with what they try to bring aboard airplanes. The agency says screeners have confiscated millions of weapons, including guns, knives, and box cutters. NPR's Pam Fessler has more.
The Transportation Security Administration says that in the past year and a half, screeners have stopped passengers from bringing 2.3 million knives, 1,400 guns, and almost 50,000 box cutters on board airplanes. The agency says it found razor blades in one passenger's tennis shoes and stopped another passenger with a 9-inch knife hidden inside an artificial leg. Last month in Florida, screeners discovered a loaded handgun inside a teddy bear being carried by a child. TSA has come under criticism for screening practices that appear to vary from airport to airport. The agency says travelers can check its website for the most current guidelines on what is and isn't allowed to be brought on board. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 40 points to close at 9,374 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq gained 18 points, or 1%, to close at 1,800. This is NPR News.
Free at last! Free at last! Thank God Almighty, we are free at last!
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said those words 40 years ago today on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. Hundreds of people gathered in the civil rights leader's hometown of Atlanta today to commemorate the anniversary of King's I Have a Dream speech. Emily Kopp reports from Georgia Public Radio.
After a mile-long march in 90-degree heat, the crowd arrived at the Martin Luther King Jr. historic site. There, they paid homage to King's speech at the March on Washington 40 years ago. Congressman John Lewis told the crowd to remember the past, but look to the future.
It is time to agitate. It is time to organize. It is time to get involved and make America what America must be.
Lewis was joined on stage by Coretta Scott King and other civil rights leaders and politicians. Some speakers urged the mostly African-American crowd to honor King's legacy by voting. Others denounced the war in Iraq, saying King believed nonviolence was the best way to achieve change. For NPR News, I'm Emily Kopp in Atlanta.
A friend and supporter of Dr. King died today in Greensboro, North Carolina. Willa Player was the first black woman in the United States to head a four-year college. Player was the president of Bennett College in Greensboro in 1958, and she gave Reverend King a forum to make a civil rights speech when no other group or institution in the city would host him. The speech was considered an important catalyst for the desegregation movement in Greensboro. Willa Player was 94 years old. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Warner Home Video, featuring Roger and Me, Michael Moore's first film, available now on DVD.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Book Week on our show, featuring interviews with the authors of all sorts of books. Today, advice books on how to speak and what not to wear. When you're nervous or self-conscious, it can affect your voice. That's one reason why Patsy Rodenberg is often in the wings coaching actors on opening nights. Patsy Rodenberg is a vocal coach who has trained many leading British actors, including Ralph Fiennes, Sir Ian McKellen, Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, Trevor Nunn, and Daniel Day-Lewis. Rodenberg is the director of voice at London's Royal National Theatre and the Guildhall School of Music and Drama. But she doesn't work just with actors. She's trained public speakers of every sort, from teachers to politicians. She's written books for actors and for the rest of us. I asked her what kind of work she does with actors backstage to help them prepare for performances.
There are certain things that can happen to people when they're very stressful. A lot of the listeners will feel it. It's not only actors. But if you get very nervous, you tend to lift out of your body. What I mean by that is the shoulders start to come up. The jaw might tighten. And if that happens, you stop breathing. In fact, if you just lift your shoulders now and you try that, it's quite hard to get the breath in. If you can't get the breath in, you've got no power. You can't think, you can't feel. So that needs to be centred, which means maybe a lot of releasing across the shoulders, the upper chest where the sternum is. People get very tight there. This is completely unnatural for the human body, but that's the sort of stress we put on ourselves. And when that happens, the breath fails. And within about 3 or 4 minutes of trying to use your voice begins to diminish. So people will say to me, it's rather moving actually, they say, I'm much more interesting than I sound. And it's because their voice is being trapped. Because, I personally believe that everyone has a fantastic voice.
Can you give us an example of a couple of the warm-up kind of exercises you'll give actors to do right before a performance to warm up their voice, to get them breathing in a relaxed way, in a deep way?
I would start by checking in on their body. I would check in the placing of their head, their shoulders, the release of the shoulders, the spine. When you get very nervous, a lot of people might collapse through the spine. As soon as that happens, the voice tightens, the breath stops. The way you stand is terribly important. You see, a lot of what I'm talking about is about subliminal communication. I would say to anybody, long before somebody speaks, you know whether you're going to listen to them. So the body, centering the body, stretching the rib cage. You know, there are certain parts of the body that gets very rusty very quickly. The rib cage will go within about 3 or 4 days of not working it. So this area around the center of the body has to be kept flexible and strong to power the voice.
Can you demonstrate a couple of the vocal warm-ups?
Well, after getting the breath into place and getting the breath underneath the voice so that the voice is being used with the breath, you start to warm up the voice. You start very gentle humming. Very simple. All over the place. Just beginning to get the voice warming up. And when it warms up, it begins to feel, it doesn't splutter. If you try that first thing in the morning, it splutters. So you basically get the voice motoring. You then warm up resonators, the amplifiers of the voice, the head, the nose, the face, the throat, the chest. You then warm up a range of the voice. Now, all this work, the image I always give to actors is, I want them to know the work so well that they can forget it. So you have to get all this going in order for them not to think about their voice on stage. I don't want them to think about their voice.
How do you warm up the resonators in your head?
Well, if you put your hand on your head and you hum right up there, you start to get a buzz up there and the whole voice begins to lift. And if you hum into your nose, you'll feel a buzz there. The quality will change. And as the voice warms up, you can get stronger and stronger with these exercises.
You know, you point out that when we talk about singers, we praise them for having a big range. Oh, she can sing 2 octaves, 3 octaves. But we kind of forget about that with speech. And you say most people just speak across, say, 3 notes when they could be speaking across several octaves.
Absolutely. And organically, if we get excited about an idea or passionately connected to a feeling, the voice wants to move. It's that the voice has been closed down. We all come into the world with this magnificent instrument. I must work on a voice for maybe 50 hours a week, voices. It never ceases to amaze me how extraordinary the human voice is, but most of us don't use it.
Is there a way you could give me an example of the difference between speaking on, say, 3 different notes and then using the full range of the voice
If I just now close down my voice, you know, you can hear me, but really, nothing's really going on, is it? I mean, I'm now just sort of droning on. Now, this is very naughty of me, but some people use it as a technique to put people to sleep so that they get their way. You know, you can just drone on and on and on. But if you actually want to speak about something that matters to you, naturally the voice would move. I mean, it gets excited. I mean, my voice moves. Your voice moves when you get animated. That's the human voice.
Are there exercises that you give people to help them use their full range when they're speaking?
The first exercise would just be to simply stretch it. Not sing, but just come down through your range on a glide. You just start doing something that simple. Now, what most people start to notice when they do that are there are little breaks or blips, and that means that the voice has got tension in certain places. So we might not know that break or blip is there, but unconsciously we do know that, so we don't use our voice in that place. So some people will say to me, I've got 2 voices. I've got my top voice and my bottom voice, and in between is a break. So the first stage is to stretch the voice out, to absolutely get it free, and then dare use it. So I'd make people, not only actors, but people who have to command attention in any field of life, I would make them speak using that range until they feel that they can. And then you want to say to them, now that is worked out, forget it. And the voice will sound more interesting. It will perk up.
Now, you point out in your book that many singers are frightened of speaking and many speakers are frightened of singing, and that those 2 voices rarely meet and overlap with ease. You say there's often a grinding of vocal gears as a singer moves into speaking or a speaker into singing. Why is that?
I think it's because they've been taught that there is a speaking voice and a singing voice as opposed to a whole voice. Many singers know they've worked their voice very particularly, sometimes 7 hours a day, just the singing voice, and they don't necessarily feel that connects to the speaking voice. So you will often hear a singer introduce a song, you know, maybe in a recital, and they become inaudible because they don't realize that speaking requires work in the same way as singing. Fantastic exercise that will link the voice is intoning. It's something I would ask anyone to do if they want to open up their voice.
What's the exercise?
1, 2, 3, you know, just intone. Just keep a very steady, fluent sound coming out. And it sounds very odd. Some people get very embarrassed. But 1, 2, 3, 4. And as you start to do that, the voice begins to motor. If you then drop into speaking from intoning, you often get a very strong speaking voice. So it'd be something like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. As opposed to, most of us sort of do this sort of speaking when a lot of singers, they will pull back. But if they can tap into their singing power and make a transition actually on the same breath, which is a trick, it shocks them into it. The spoken voice begins to be like the singing voice. And if you're a speaker that wants to sing, the intoning can take you into singing.
You know, I think it's particularly true of a lot of women that they speak in one octave and then sing much higher than that.
Yes.
Why is that?
This is very complex, but I'll try and explain it simply. Most women, with their bodies, it starts in the bodies, close down their bodies. They tighten around their bodies. They stand with their feet together. They clamp their thighs. All those physical constrictions stop the breath. And so when they speak, the voice is actually tighter than it should be. Now, it just so happens that at the particular moment we live in, the whim of fashion is to have a lower voice. So a lot of women, in order to get power, push their voices down, you know, there. So that when they start to sing, the voice begins to jump up away from the tension. The pushing down on the voice is another form of tension. But put that with all the sort of physical squeezing that a lot of women do in their bodies, you know, tightening the shoulders, tightening the waist and everything, holding the stomach in. You need to release your stomach in order to use your voice. This is very hard for people when they feel that they have to hold their stomach in. But if you open those tensions and just try using your voice, the voice will change.
My guest is vocal coach Patsy Rodenberg. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Patsy Rodenberg. She's the director of voice at London's Royal National Theatre and the Guildhall School of Music and Drama. She's written books for actors and public speakers. Do you work with people about finding the natural placement of their voice or the natural range of their voice?
Absolutely.
How do you
That's
find
where I
that?
Start.
How do you find that?
You start again by releasing useless tensions in the body. You then concentrate on getting the breath into the body. Most of us don't take our full breath. We don't feel the breath enter right in, right the way down to the low abdominal area. So that's the first series of habits. We all come into the world with this fantastic voice. If you listen to a baby cry, tiny little vocal folds, the voice goes on and on, this amazing range, and gradually it closes down. This is my philosophy. If the voice is free and is not trapped and is powered by the breath, it will go where it wants to go. And also, at that moment, you will find that you have a center to your voice, which is what you're born with. The voice has a particular note. We can extend away from that, but most people today don't speak with their free voice. They speak with a lot of tension in their voice. So the whole of the work starts. If I'm training young actors, that takes about a year to find their natural voice, as opposed to what I call their habitual voice, the habits that we've gathered that clutter the voice.
And is there an exercise you'd give an actor to help them find what their most comfortable or most natural speaking range is?
Yes. I would isolate what they tend to do to stop themselves. I mean, the worst thing you can do to your voice, and you see it on chat shows, you see it in those sort of trial shows that you have in America, is to push the voice. Because that, you think you're being authoritative, but you're actually blocking your voice, and it hurts. If ever your voice is uncomfortable, if it tires, if it hurts after using it, you're in some way doing some damage. A lot of people do this, you know, this is what I call, it's actually devoicing. When I do this, I'm using half my vocal folds. I'm not using my whole voice. And this is very tiring. I call it, it's a bit naughty of me, but I call it the caring voice. I was doing a lecture recently in London to the Freud Society, and I was doing these voices, and I looked at all of them when I was doing it and suddenly realised that I'd done the therapist voice, you know. This is this voice. which is, I'm really listening, I'm really... But in fact, it's actually, if you just do that for a bit, anybody, you can feel that the voice begins to tighten. So those sorts of habits are maybe fashions. So I unlock that habit and then get the voice completely without... You shouldn't feel the voice. The first thing you should feel is that the voice leaves you. The word has left you. So I would use maybe very gentle ooh sound. The human voice works like an arc. It's up and out. So I would get somebody to look at a point just above eye line and very gently send a sound there like ooh. And eventually they begin to feel that there's no pressure in the throat at all. The voice just leaves. If they feel this pressure, there's the oldest trick in the book, which is to think of a yawn. And as you think of a yawn, the throat opens and the voice escapes. Now, I know you can't speak yawning, but it's a way of beginning to feel the freedom. And as soon as the voice gets free, not only do you have more options and the voice will move more organically, but people listen to you.
Can you do that yawn thing that you're talking about?
Well, if I just think... In fact, actually, it was how they used to train actors about 80 years ago. You know, to speak on the edge of a yawn, which is why they all sounded like that. Yeah. But we can't do that anymore, nor should we, because it sounds odd. But if you just start... It's a very good warm-up exercise. If you start just speaking on the edge of a yawn, the throat begins to open. Breath comes in freer because there's no blockage in the throat. If you then just take yourself into speaking, thinking of that yawn... The voice starts to feel easy, effortless.
What is it that enables an actor to project in a large theater without shouting?
A free voice. Something that I call support, which is the breath underneath the voice. Getting the breath in and then underneath the voice, so it's actually powering the voice. Here's a very simple... Again, what I call a cheap trick. If you push against a wall gently and keep your shoulders free and you begin to breathe, you will feel your breath engage lower muscles in the body, muscles in the abdominal area. And if you then very gently speak with that push, your voice will suddenly get much more clear and powerful. The next stage is to allow the word to leave you. Now, that sounds very odd, but if you want to be heard, even on a microphone, the voice has to be finished outside you. So people do a lot of swallowing, you know. You know, if I pull back my voice now, you know, I just pull it back, you know. I don't finish the word. You've got to breathe, support, keep the voice free, and define the word in space. You don't need to be loud. You can be very clear in space, as long as... those three things are in place.
The exercise we were talking about where you're pushing against the wall to, I guess, connect with your breath, is that?
Yes, and you then speak with the outward breath, with that power coming through your body and supporting the voice. Actually, you can do it in a meeting. You're being bullied, somebody's getting at you. Even if you put your hand on a desk and just push into that desk, the breath will drop into the body. You will take tension away from the shoulders, which will always weaken your voice. You've got no chance, really, to communicate effectively if there's tension in the shoulders. I mean, if you just push against the desk and breathe, the voice begins, the breath begins to settle in the body, and then you have the power.
Do you work with politicians?
Yes, I do.
What kind of problems do they come to you with, and what typically do you work with them on?
Well, there are certain arenas that politicians have to work in. In the House of Commons in London, it's an arena, a geography of conflict. So for lots of women, that is very, very difficult. Women are better communicators in more informal settings because, again, their habits of giving in and giving way. So I do a lot of the young women members of parliament who find it very intimidating to talk across that geography of conflict. And I did one whole session a year or so ago. They have to stand up to ask a question. Now, if they don't stand up with authority and energy and centre, nobody notices them It's quite extraordinary. I had 30 of them, and I watched them on television, and they were standing up and wobbling and then trying to ask a question and apologising, snatching their breath. If you snatch the breath, I call it the victim breath. As soon as somebody does that, they're easy, they're pushovers. So I did a whole session with them, just standing up, breathing and asking the question with authority. And within a week, they were being noticed. So those particular women had huge problems even getting noticed because of their habits. They're good listeners, that's all fantastic, but in that arena, it didn't serve them. The other arena that I work with, a cabinet, a young cabinet member daring to answer the Prime Minister back and doing it with authority, getting into the conversation, and men have these habits as well, but women, they will trail off. What I call the falling line, also very hard to be heard in space if you have the falling line, which is this thing of, you know, I just start speaking, then I just drop off. I give up halfway. Now, men are very good at holding debate, following that energy through. Now, if you try and ask a question to somebody and you trail off, you're not going to be noticed again. So again, it's not so dramatic, but in order to hold your voice, to hold the space, what I call own the space with your voice, so that people notice you, and that can be trained.
I think a lot of times when people's voices trail off, it's because they're not confident of what they're saying, or they're
Absolutely.
Not sure where the thought is going. I know that happens to me a lot. I start a thought, and then I think, I have no idea how I'm going to end
this.
But
you stop it with energy, you see. You don't apologize and drop back in. What I'm talking about is you can actually see people dropping back into themselves. The whole energy of this voice is just pulling in. You can stop, but hold your energy out. You know, and that is about, you're absolutely right. I'm talking about the technical thing. You're talking about something as important, if not more important, feeling that you have the right to speak. And if you don't feel you have the right to speak, you develop habits like that falling off, which give you less right to speak and more rights to other people to squash you.
Patsy Rodenberg is the director of voice at London's Royal National Theatre and the Guildhall School of Music and Drama. Our interview was recorded in 2000 after the publication of her book, The Actor Speaks. We'll hear more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Stones of Summer, the novel that inspired the film Stone Reader, available October 22nd at Barnes & Noble stores and online at www.bn.com, and from Anchor Books, publishers of the new paperback by Thomas L. Friedman, Longitudes and Attitudes, The World in the Age of Terrorism. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, fashion crimes and misdemeanors. We hear from the creators of the BBC's What Not to Wear, Trini Woodall and Susanna Constantine. Their book of the same name is a bestseller. And we continue our conversation with Patsy Rodenberg as our book week continues. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with vocal coach Patsy Rodenberg. She's trained many top British actors, including Judi Dench, Ian McKellen, and Daniel Day-Lewis. Rodenberg is the director of voice at London's Royal National Theatre and the Guildhall School of Music and Drama. Her books include The Actor Speaks and Speaking Shakespeare. She works with all sorts of public speakers, from teachers to politicians. Now, one thing politicians have to do is make speeches and read from a text that they may or may not have written themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people are in that position of having to give a speech to a group that they belong to or to people who they work with or, you know, at a conference or whatever. What's some of your advice to people who have to read from a script? And I mean, they're not actors, but no. They still want to sound natural, even though it's an unnatural situation.
I think you can try it. You can do two things that are very, very useful that will help immediately. You can warm up. It's not going to happen. If you're getting nervous and you've got to read, you should at least practice a bit of breathing, getting the breath, warming up the voice. But a lot of people come to me and they say, I work on these speeches and they never work. And I just ask a very simple question. And I say, do you work on them out aloud? And they say, no. Well, you can't work on your voice silently. You've got to, even if you get the first sentence and read the sentence out aloud before a presentation, at least you're giving yourself physical memory of what it's going to be like. You can mouth the text quietly, but the mouth is doing the work, so you're actually feeling the word in your mouth so that you're telling the muscles what to do. It's more than an intellectual process, speaking. It's a physical process. And the other thing I would say to anybody who had to, on a regular basis, read out, is practice. Read out aloud every day. Use your voice. Within 10 days, it gets easier.
Now, you know, you were talking before about some of the things that happen to us physically when we're nervous, as we often are before we have to do public speaking, or as actors are before they go on stage. You know, the shoulders get tense and the breath gets constricted. But I think many of us tend to talk faster when we're more nervous, too. And
yes.
That's a bad thing if you're trying to communicate. But sometimes you're so self-conscious in that situation of public speaking that it's hard to take control over all the things that you should be concerned about.
A couple of little tricks. Do you want some tricks?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Now, again, we're going back to the breath and then I'll go to the word. When you get fast, it's because you're breathing ahead of your head. When people rush, it's because their voice and their breath have divided. In acting terms, we have a saying called being in the moment. You have to just mean what you say as you say it. When you get very, very nervous, it's like your head has trotted off and your mouth can't keep up. So you start sort of stumbling. The number one trick is to take the breath, and if you're feeling very nervous, even halfway through a presentation, adjust your shoulders. Nobody will see you. The other thing you can do is just very gently, quietly, sigh out. As you sigh out, the breath calms down, and then you can start again. So number one trick, try and breathe slowly and deeply and calmly. Before you do the presentation, you can make yourself do it almost unbearably slowly, and that will help the muscles remember what they have to do. But the next trick is you can keep yourself at the right pace if you speak the whole word. When you listen to somebody rushing, you know, half the words are going, you know, half the words are not spoken, and they just sort of skid, rather like Bambi on ice. They just skid all over the text. So you just try and speak clearly. And that will help.
So you recommend, among other things, that before you even begin to give the talk, while you're waiting backstage or
yes.
whatever, that you do a lot of deep, slow breathing.
Do you know, we do this organically. I've got most of my exercises from watching people under stress. People under stress will often put their hand on the upper chest, and that is to stop the breath lifting there, because that is a way of trying to get the breath down. Or if you push with one hand against a wall and just take your time, breathe in calmly. Everything's going to be better in life if you breathe. I always say to my dentist, why don't you have breathe written on the ceiling? because as your tooth is being filled, it would be better. But, you know, we just forget these basic things.
Now, a lot of people are confused about what the difference is between breathing from your chest and breathing from your diaphragm. And I know vocal teachers always talk about the importance of breathing from the diaphragm. If you don't know how to breathe from the diaphragm...
Well, I talk about it...
Yeah.
The low abdominal area.
Uh-huh.
Here's a little exercise you can do.
Yeah.
If you sit on a chair and your feet are firmly on the floor, and remember that if your feet aren't on the floor, it's harder to breathe, flop over, put your elbows on your knees, release the back of your neck, release your shoulders so that you're flopped over, and very gently begin to breathe in and out. Within a few breaths, you will start to feel the back of the rib cage begin to move. The back of the rib cage moving easily. And that means that the breath is going lower into the body. If you then gently sit up, the breath will feel calmer. You can take this further. You can hug yourself, stand, hug yourself, keep the shoulders released, although you're hugging. Keep your knees released. A lot of tension, and a lot of people when they speak in public shake profoundly because their knees are locked. You know, you cannot use your voice with locked knees. It's an absolute anatomical fact. So keep your knees released. You're hugging yourself and you flop over. And in that position again, you breathe in and out. You will start to feel the back of the rib cage. You will start to feel the abdominal area release. And at that moment, and you've just got to be a bit careful because you might feel a bit dizzy, you let your arms drop, you come up, and you feel calmer. You feel wider. The body, you know, to take proper breath means that you have to take up space.
Did you ever have vocal problems yourself?
Yes,
what
absolutely.
Kind of problems?
Well, I was sent when I was about 8 to a speech teacher, an elocution teacher, we called them then, and she was a terrifying woman. And I never achieved what she wanted me to do, which was to speak well. And I had a terrible time. And I find communicating very problematic. It scares me. I don't think you could teach with sympathy if you found it easy. So I've gone deliberately into an arena that has always frightened me.
What was your speaking like before you became
more confident? I had a stutter, and I couldn't say certain sounds, and I was mocked appallingly at school. So you just get quieter and quieter, and you don't want to read out because people are going to laugh at you. And that memory I still carry. And I then went to the leading school in the world at the time, and I started to feel, well, I might be able to do this. And in fact, I enjoy helping others that find it difficult. And you know, most actors find speaking difficult. That's why they want to be actors. They're not extroverts. All the great actors I work with are very shy people.
I have noticed that interviewing actors, that a lot of actors are, they have fantastic voices in films and on stage, but when they're speaking extemporaneously, some actors have much weaker voices and sound incredibly unsure of themselves.
Right. You see, they need a text. They need to play somebody else to release themselves. That's part of the issue. But that's maybe why they want to be an actor, and that's maybe why I wanted to be a voice coach, because it's difficult. If it matters to you, it's difficult, and it matters to me.
Patsy Rodenberg, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Patsy Rodenberg is the director of voice at London's Royal National Theatre and the Guildhall School of Music and Drama. I spoke with her in 2000, after the publication of her book, The Actor Speaks. Coming up, What Not to Wear. This is Fresh Air. My next two guests think they know what I should wear, and they probably wouldn't be satisfied with what you're wearing either. Trini Woodall and Susanna Constantine are the hosts of the BBC series What Not to Wear, which is shown here on BBC America. It was one of the first hit makeover shows. An American version of the program is shown on the Learning Channel. Woodall and Constantine also have a book called What Not to Wear, which was recently published in paperback in the U.S. Here's how their show works. A woman who is totally lacking in fashion sense is nominated by family and friends for a makeover. Woodall and Constantine ambush the woman and tell her she's been chosen for the show and that she's been secretly filmed so that she can, and we can, get a good look at her fashion problems. Then the hosts go through the woman's closet with her, demonstrate how awful her clothes are, throw the biggest offenders in a trash can, and give her £2,000, about $4,000, to buy a new wardrobe with their help. The hosts say they need to be cruel to be kind. Here's a scene in which Woodall and Constantine demonstrate their credo while working with a middle-aged woman of Indian descent, watching the secret footage they shot of her.
How much black do you wear?
Quite a bit.
You do, don't you? Can you see how that black is making you look really tired and enhancing your dark circles under your eyes?
But it's making me look slimmer.
It's not making you look slimmer. It's making you look like you've got jaundice. You know, actually, cut is what makes you look slimmer.
Oh, my God.
You are out in public. You are in a supermarket. You look like you're wearing a sack. Shame on you, woman.
But that's comfortable sack.
Oh. If you only had comfortable clothes that were flattering for you, you'd never go to that kind of shoddiness.
The goal of What Not to Wear isn't to turn the woman into a fashion model. I asked Susanna Constantine what the goal is.
It's really important for us to look at a woman's lifestyle as well as the way she looks physically. So we take into account whether she's got children, what kind of job she has, where she wants to go, whether she wants to get the man, whether she wants to get the divorce, whether she wants to get the job. And then we look at her figure and we make her understand what she loves and hates about her body. And we explain that, you know, she doesn't need to go on the diet, she doesn't need to have surgery, she doesn't need to exercise. She can make a huge difference by wearing the right clothes today, here and now.
You know what I was wondering? If a lot of, like, husbands who have no clue about how to dress and have, you know, awful haircuts and really old eyeglass frames are complaining to you about how their wives look.
It's not really, I mean, more often than not, it's kind of really good girlfriend or a female family member that's nominated them. And sometimes it is the husband. Generally, when it's the husband, if he is a kind of spotty little nerd, he is nominating his wife through love because he feels that she really needs a break. We have had, you know, a few disillusioned men who have nominated their partners because they think that they do need to look better, but really, in actual fact, they're the ones who should be looking at themselves at the end of the day. And that's quite evident in the show. It's like by the end of the show, you know, the woman has moved on to such a level that this poor bloke has been left behind. And we had one instance where a really sweet couple and the husband nominated the wife, and along with her sister, his sisters, the ugly sisters, and who should have been on our show. And by the end of it, Maria looked so wonderful, and Matthew, the husband, was left behind. And he felt really gutted that his wife had now become this sort of glamorous icon in his eyes. And she then nominated him for the show, and we made him over. And by the end of that, they were level pegging, and it was a very happy ending to the story.
You're afraid they would have gotten divorced had you not done the makeover for him afterwards?
No, I just think it was very charming with him as a man, because we all know, you know, as women, we can discuss issues of how we feel about our bodies quite openly. And I think men, it's more taboo. And this man was a quite a large man. And I remember he said this comment to Susanna. He said, I feel like, you know, the big fat man at the back of the pub. And he was quite emotional and expressive. So it was amazing to you know, dress him so that he felt that he'd lost, like, you know, 50 pounds. And he felt handsome, he felt sexually attractive, all the things that had just gone from his life.
People show you their wardrobes before you make them over. And mm-hmm. there are some pretty horrible garments in the wardrobes of the women that you choose. After all, that's why you chose them in the first place. And you throw the things that you don't like from their closets into a big trash can. Sometimes mm-hmm. you basically throw the whole closet in there and you keep, like, one item that you think is passable. Do you actually, like, give the clothes back to the woman afterwards, or do you, like, cart it off?
Those clothes are gone for good.
They're really in the dumpster for good, huh?
No, they really are. They're gone for good. And by the, you know, that is the kind of greatest hurdle to get over for a woman, because, you know, there's a lot of emotional attachment to some of these clothes, you know, these items of clothing. It might be, you know, the dress that they wore on their first date, or, you know, the cardigan they wrapped their new puppy in when it arrived. But by the end of the process, they're actually very willing to get rid of their clothes.
But gee, shouldn't they be hanging on to those things for sentimental reasons?
No, why? What's so good about the sentimentality of that?
Oh, it's like having a photograph or something, you know, it's the same thing.
I mean, some people do have items, and then what they do is they end up framing them and hanging them on the wall, which is quite amusing. But what they can do, we sometimes make three piles. We make the pile to give to friends that you shopped with who suit, you know, those clothes suited them a lot better than they ever suited you. Then we have a sort of resale pile where they can, you know, get some money back and sell them in a secondhand store. And then we have the kind of two disgusting to even give to any one pile, and those do go in the trash.
You know, here's the problem I run into when I clean out my closet. I look at that big, ugly but warm sweater, and I say to myself, I could get rid of this because it's kind of too ugly to wear, but if there's war or famine, I'll really want the warmth of this sweater, and I won't care that it's ugly.
That is so extreme,
isn't it?
You must have the gas mask. You must have the bunker.
No, I have none of that. I have nothing. I have nothing.
I just have this
incredible guilt about getting rid of clothes.
Yeah, but you know, someone else out there, less fortunate than you, maybe could really benefit from those clothes. So maybe give it to charity, and then you know that some...
That is what I do.
Well, that's the way to go. And then someone else who doesn't even have a roof over their head will benefit from your warm jersey. Yeah.
They'll have the good clothes if there's a war.
Yeah,
exactly.
You'll freeze.
That's right. Yeah. What are some of the biggest offenders that you typically trash? The offenders that show up in the most closets?
I think the universal offender is the pleated, tapered, chino-type trouser, which is very high-waisted.
Are you wearing those now, Tim?
I am not, no.
Good girl. And they are something that, you know, offends every woman's shape. So if you have a flabby tummy and you have that kind of pleated, high-waisted trouser, your stomach will just begin to resemble a waterbed. And if you have hips and you have these trousers, then all you look at when you see a woman's shape who has bigger hips is the width of her hips, because the trouser is so tapered at the bottom towards the ankle that it distorts your leg. If you have a big butt, high-waisted trousers, especially sans pockets at the back, will just make your bottom so huge that people will just be staggered by it.
Our lovely lady engineer, who we can see through the window giggling, is looking at her own pair of trousers, yeah. And I think she's going to take them off in a minute and put them in the trash can.
So what are some of the other typical offenders that you find in women's closets?
Well, something that is actually stronger in America than in England are the same thing in a short. And you have much better weather here. But, you know, walking down the streets of New York in the last few days, we have seen many women who could be, you know, 16 or could be 60, and they wear shorts, chino shorts. And they're like a men's short, you know, and they're kind of wider than they are long, with probably double the amount of pleats. And that is just the most unflattering thing for a woman.
It's so unfeminine. There's nothing appealing about those shorts. And there are so many alternatives out there. Why not just wear a skirt? Skirt is much cooler. You don't get a sweaty gusset. You know, it's like, let the air get in between your legs. You know, it's much cooler to wear a skirt. Women are very fortunate. Men, it's harder. So men, you know, for men, shorts are a good alternative, as long as they don't have the pleats at the front and they're more like a Bermuda short, they can get away with it.
Susanna, for Tara's women, been very quiet. I'm wondering if she's got
she's
some
areas.
No, I'll tell you what I was thinking, though. Here's what I'm thinking. Mm-hmm. I'm one of the people who, like, never wear skirts. I always feel like...
What's wrong with your legs?
It's not even a question of hiding my legs. It's that I feel like I walk differently and I sit differently, and it's somehow I don't feel me in a skirt.
So are you scared of being feminine?
I wouldn't say I'm scared of being feminine, but I don't. I think I just tend to wear more like, you know, like shirts and jackets and pants and.
So you feel more comfortable to be androgynous?
I don't think it's quite androgynous, but
do you wear dresses?
Nah.
Okay.
We need to get our hands on Terry. That's the bottom line. We need any of Terry's friends who are listening to this show, when we come out to America, please nominate her, because it sounds like we need to get our hands on her.
No, but why should I have to wear a skirt or a dress or look, quote, feminine?
Well, unless you have legs like mine, which Susanna says boots were invented for because my calves and ankles are so thick, I think that... And also, can I ask you, Terry, how tall are you?
I'm really short. I'm about 5 feet.
Another little point with that is that when you are shorter, if you wear a neat skirt, you look taller than if you wear trousers sometimes.
What do you mean by
as
a
long
neat
as you
skirt?
Keep
do you mean...
I don't mean like a huge A-line rah-rah skirt, okay, right, which would just wear you, because I think the shorter one is, you have to be quite neat with your clothes. But if you always wear trousers, and if you wore a neat little jacket nipped in, quite, you know, showing off your figure, that might be okay. But I somehow think that's not the kind of jacket you wear. I do feel it's more of a men-shaped blazer that you might wear. Tell me if I'm wrong, though.
I don't know. What do the people in the control room think?
Well,
they say just, you're wrong. You know. They say you're wrong about the jacket.
Okay, so they do say you wear nipped in feminine jackets, do they? No, I don't think so. Come on. Come on. Okay, but basically, if you wore a little skirt and a sort of fitted top and you show your legs off, by showing more legs and arms, it will make you taller.
Huh.
Just trust me. I mean, it's really worth a try.
But also, I know. Wait a minute. I know you'd also suggest that I wear heels, which I really can't
no.
do.
No. Not at all. As soon as a smaller person starts wearing a very high heel, she looks like a small person who wants to be taller, okay? It's much better to have the confidence to wear, you know, a little low kitten heel if you want to be more elegant, or flat shoes. You know, you are what you are, and you should be proud of that. You know, small things are perfectly formed, and you know, for lots of reasons, you're very lucky to be small. But... You know, it's also a question of wearing, I bet, your suits, you know, probably quite dark, and then you'll wear a bright-coloured shirt underneath to cheer it up. Yeah?
Okay, I think you got my MO, yeah.
Okay. So, you know, it's much better to wear one colour and have all the colours merging into each other, because then that, again, will elongate your height. You don't need to wear high heels to look taller. There are all sorts of different tricks.
My guests are Trini Woodall and Susanna Constantine, hosts of the BBC show What Not to Wear, and author of the book of the same name. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Trini Woodall and Susanna Constantine, hosts of the BBC series What Not to Wear, and the authors of the book of the same name. When you do makeovers of men, what are some of the typical problems you are up against?
Exactly the same as women, but I think the most prevalent one is the beer gut, the big fat stomach that is winched in with a very tight belt, and then encased in a pair of pleat-fronted trousers, which are also tapered, and or otherwise shorts, which are of the same shape. And it's a question of getting them into flat-fronted trousers with no pleats that are bootleg, and layering their top half to break up the expanse of stomach that's there. So, but men are exactly the same as women. They, and some of them even have breasts.
Yeah, and then you have to do the same principle. They have to wear a two-button jacket and not a three- or four-button jacket. It's like a woman wearing a princess collar neckline who's got big breasts, which just makes her one huge breast, or breaking it down with a deep V jacket. Same applies to a man.
So if a man has a big belly, is the appropriate place to put the waist in the middle of that big belly or underneath the big belly?
It's really to give no sense of where the belly is the best solution. Because if you're doing a belt, you're winching underneath and then it just pours over. It's like a woman who's got a belly wearing too tight a jeans. You see it anyway. And if you do it too high, it's like the woman wearing the pleated trousers, which are very high-waisted. So in a way, you wear a trouser that fits smoothly, probably just under the belly, and then over it is, as Susanna was saying, that layering where you might have a T-shirt and then a jumper over, and you show neatly a bit of the T-shirt. So you just break up and you deceive your eye as to where that belly is actually getting biggest.
Now, do you think that people often get stuck on the look that they wore when they were in their teens, the look that was popular when they were teenagers?
I think where people get stuck is the look in the decade they felt happiest. Okay. Uh-huh. And I think a huge era of that is the sort of 60s woman. And you see her today and she still has long flowing hair. She might wear the sort of makeup she wore then, but unfortunately a few more wrinkles have appeared. The garments might be quite flowing, but now she's got a bit of a belly and she should be trying to show off some kind of figure. So you really find that, and when we go through, you know, if a woman's from 30 to 60, you'll find that decade, and we sort of pinpoint it, we say that's when you felt happiest. And in the last series, we had a woman, Sandy, and she had really had a moment in the early 80s, and she hadn't left that moment. And they were, you know, she could hardly walk through the door with the width of her shoulder pads. So it's kind of readdressing and saying, you know, the decade we want to feel happiest in is the one we're living in today, if that's possible.
How did you start the show? You already knew each other and you were friends?
We knew each other and we started a newspaper column in the Daily Telegraph for 7 years, talking honestly about fashion and what was available. And then we did some satellite television for about 3 or 4 years, where we did about 200 shows, budget of $500 a show, viewers 7. And then we had an internet company, we had another book, and then we were approached by the BBC to do this show about 3 years ago, and we're in our third series, second book, and a few other things in the pipeline.
Do you ever wish that you didn't care about how you look and you didn't really care about your clothes in the way that some of the women who you do on your show don't really care about how they look or don't really care that much about clothes?
I think every woman cares about the way she looks, and she might not admit it, or she might be in denial, or she might think there are more important things in her life. I think there are very, very few women out there who have the confidence in themselves not to care about the way they look.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's been really great to
talk
to you.
Yeah, really fantastic.
And we have to
thank
do you, Terry. We have to come down. Where are you? In Washington?
Philadelphia.
I have come down to Philadelphia on our next trip, and I think we need to have a little day out.
Well, I'd enjoy it.
You say with trepidation. Yeah.
Well, thank you again. Trini Woodall and Susanna Constantine are the hosts of the BBC's What Not to Wear, which is also shown on BBC America. Their book of the same name has been published in paperback. I spoke with them last month. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Place of Hiding, a novel of mystery set on the island of Guernsey by Elizabeth George, author of the Inspector Lindley Mysteries. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we conclude our book week with the authors of books about TV and film. We hear from Paul Feig, creator of the TV series Freaks and Geeks, and author of the memoir Kick Me, Adventures in Adolescence, and David Thompson, author of the Biographical Dictionary of Film. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.